to secure geopolitical gains elsewhere. If the MPLA achieved power with its strong connections to the Cubans and to the Russians, you would see the first serious physical penetration of the East Bloc into African affairs. And we regarded that as a strategic threat. We provided arms and financing to hire mercenaries, provide trainers, provide weaponry to Roberto's armed elements, and through Mobutu, that equipment and funding was put before the FNLA.
Not only the Americans were keen to contain the possible Soviet influence in the region. To the south of Angola, apartheid South Africa was eyeing developments with concern.
Communism, as far as South Africa was concerned, was a real threat. A threat in the sense of dictating, taking over the whole of the country. And we couldn't have that situation here in South Africa, that they could come through and instigate and plant the ideology of Marxism here in Southern Africa. And that meant we're the next target. We're the cherry on the cake.
The South African Defense Force decided to move into Angola.
That phase was a phase of guns and money. You don't have guns and money, you don't have power. You can have dreams. You don't have, you have no guns, you have no money, no politics.
The scheduled date for independence was approaching fast. With U.S. logistical support, the FNLA troops, accompanied by soldiers from Mobutu's regular army, advanced from the north. UNITA soldiers, along with the South African army, moved up from the south. The MPLA, despite receiving consignments of Soviet weapons, suddenly found itself at a disadvantage. This was not to be another covert operation like those Cuba had conducted in Africa throughout the 1960s. Fidel had decided to engage overtly in Angola. Cuba's elite special forces were dispatched, along with 35,000 foot soldiers, to help Neto's men. Operation Carlota guaranteed that Cuba would play a major role on the Angolan battlefield.
We were worried about Cuban involvement because at that stage, the talks about limitation of strategic weapons were taking place. There was talk about Brezhnev's visit to the United States, which never take place, by the way, after this episode.
My assumptions then were that the involvement of the Cubans was Russian-driven. It took me years later to reach a different conclusion, that the Cubans played to bring the Russians in support. That news reached Washington in the summer of 75, and I remember it was greeted with considerable concern. This is the first time foreign military forces had been introduced onto the continent of Africa since the colonial period back at the turn of the century. First time. We felt at that point that it was necessary to face this Cuban issue head on, square on.
Cuba is a red flag in the United States because anything that Cuba does, we hate. So when they sent troops to Angola, we had no choice but to say this is the end of détente, even though the Soviets really were not responsible. To see Cubans operating anywhere outside of Cuba was something that we considered a defeat for the United States.
So whatever Cuba does, the U.S. has to oppose. This is from Cuba, an African odyssey. Cuba had 35,000 foot soldiers fighting alongside liberation fighters in Angola. The number is 212-209-2950. I just need 14 more people calling, pledging at the $150 level for this brilliant film, Cuba, an African odyssey. Fantasy by filmmaker Jihad El Tahari. She was born in Beirut, Lebanon. She is an award-winning writer, director, and producer. And she received her master's in political science from American University in Cairo. She has worked as a news correspondent covering the Middle East with U.S. News and World Report and also Reuters. She has produced and directed numerous documentaries. I have a special arrangement with Jihan El Tahari to make this DVD available to you. It's the official version of Cuba, an African Odyssey. It is the official version, and which is very, very difficult to get. It has been in the Pan-African Film Festival. It's won the award in the Pan-African Film Festival. The number is 212-209-2950. I need to raise another $2,100. I need six people calling, getting our amazing dollar a day pack. And I want to make a last call for this material. We're wrapping up this fund drive this week. Sojourner Truth, we've got two more days of the drive. I'm making a last call right now for this material. We've got to make our goal for this hour. If not, I can no longer offer this material. And it would be a crying shame because I worked so hard to get it for you. And the dollar a day pack, there are four DVDs and two books. The four DVDs are Cuba, an African Odyssey DVD. Oliver Stone's Looking for Fidel, where Oliver Stone sits down and has a candid, in-depth interview with Fidel Castro. It also is Lumumba, the classic film about the young African leader, Patrice Lumumba, who was assassinated with the complicity of the CIA and Belgian officials. His assassination was dealt a blow to liberation and revolutionary movements on the continent of Africa, but throughout the global South, those of us in the Caribbean region, in Cuba, people, black folks in the U.S., everybody was mourning Lumumba. We're also offering the DVD of From Mali to Congo, What the Mainstream Media Won't Tell You About Africa, featuring Dr. Gerald Horn. Call us at 212-209-2950. The two books we're offering is Danny Schechter's book on Nelson Mandela. He's very much an expert on Nelson Mandela. It's called Madiba A to Z. And Gabriel San Ramon's book, Cultural History, Vence Ramos, charts the development of the movement from the years before Allende of Chile, his victorious campaign in Chile, and the brutal U.S.-backed military coup on September 11, 1973 that overthrew Allende and imposed the dictatorship of Pinochet. Similar playbook that happened in the Congo, where assassination of Patrice Lumumba and Mobutu, a U.S.-backed dictator, put in place. And then the U.S., you just heard in that last clip, in the battle for Angola, Angola is very wealthy in resources. It was the gem of the Portuguese Empire. Portugal did not want to lose Angola. Portugal sent 50,000 troops to fight in Angola up against the liberation movement there in Angola. And you, the film goes into detail about the help from the Cubans and the fierce fighting that went on. Agostinho Neto, vilified by Western governments, but remains a hero in Angola for leading the liberation and ending colonialism there. The number is 212-209-2950. And I need six people calling, getting the dollar a day pack. Agostinho Neto, Patrice Lumumba, Amilcar Cabral, these are names that every student, each and every one of us, should know, particularly but not only if you are of African descent. The number to call is 212-209-2950. Angola got independence in 1975 after Agostinho Nieto's MPLA defeated the organizations, the FNLA and UNITA, that were backed by apartheid South Africa and the Soviet Union, and the Cubans went in there, fought alongside Augustino Nieto's forces, and fought the U.S.-backed mercenaries and the South African mercenaries to a standstill. And that is really what led also to the ending of apartheid in South Africa, and one of the reasons that Mandela, one of his first visits, was to go to Cuba and to thank Fidel. Cuba, yet again on the ground right now in Africa, the best response of any international government. They've got 461 doctors and nurses on the ground in Africa, this time fighting Ebola, but they had 500,000 troops fighting in 17 liberation anti-colonial movements on the continent of Africa. The number is 212-209-2950. I want to go on to now another clip of a final clash in Kifungongo and Cuba's role. This is a pivotal battle that, believe me, is not in any textbook here, history textbook in the U.S., or even when people are studying the continent of Africa. I've got to raise another $2,000. I've got to make this a final call for this material. I can no longer offer this material. Call us, please, on this Black Hoodie Day. Pledge in the name of Trayvon Martin. Pledge in the name of Mike Brown and others who were killed by the police. And remember to look to see what protest actions are happening in your city today. But let's go on now back to Cuba, an African odyssey, for that next clip. Last call for this material. I've only got like 9 minutes for it. I can't offer this material any longer without getting more of a response from you. 4 DVDs and 2 books. The 4 DVDs, Cuba, an African Odyssey DVD, Academy Award winner Oliver Stone, Looking for Fidel DVD, the Lumumba, that classic film on Patrice Lumumba, assassinated by the CIA, the DVD, and From Mali to Congo, What the Mainstream Media Won't Tell You About Africa with Dr. Gerald Horn, and 2 books. Let's go to the next clip right now.
All the pieces were in place for a final showdown. It was only a week to November 11th, and all the warring parties were converging on Luanda. It seemed that the new nation would be strangled at birth. The final clash took place at Kifungondo, only 30 miles from the capital. The MPLA won the decisive battle at Kifungondo, and on the night of November 11th, 1975, 400 years of Portuguese colonialism ended. Augustino Neto was recognized as Angola's first president. The fighting did not stop with the Declaration of Independence. The United States did not recognize Neto's presidency and was more adamant than ever to dislodge his Soviet-backed government. But the American Congress feared that they would get entangled in another Vietnam, so they decided to prohibit all U.S. clandestine support to Angola. Once the U.S. supplies dried up, the MPLA managed to contain its local rivals. The South African Army also withdrew from Angola, but it continued to arm and train Jonas Savimbi's UNITA rebels. Augustino Neto had won the first round of the battle for independence, so he invited Fidel Castro to celebrate the victory his army had helped win. It was a moment of glory for Cuba. Since the 1960s, Fidel had supported no less than 17 African revolutions, but none of his ventures had been as successful as this. African leaders competed to express their personal gratitude. For 3 weeks, Fidel toured the continent, where he was treated as a hero of African independence. Cuba's internationalist policy had finally borne fruit. In the late 1970s, Angola no longer made international headlines.
Cuba fought alongside African revolutionaries to end 400 years of Portuguese colonialism on the continent of Africa. The number is 212-209-2950. Let's have an understanding as to why Africa is so impoverished today, the role of your tax dollars, the role of the CIA, this Cuba and African Odyssey, the filmmaker Jihan El-Tahari, according, here's what the Chicago Sun-Times said, she directs this comprehensive documentary on Che Guevara's role in Africa's revolutions of the 1960s and 70s. CIA and Soviet insiders are interviewed along with frontliners, which is absolutely the case. We have an amazing dollar a day pack that includes Cuba and African Odyssey. That pledge level for that DVD is $150. The number is 212-209-2950. This is the last call for this material. I've got like 5 minutes to go. We've got to raise another $2,000. We want to thank an anonymous pledger from Los Angeles getting the DVD. Ruben Flores out in Whittier, that's taking home the dollar a day pack. The number to call is 212-209-2950. Now, if you miss out on this, I'm going to run into you. You're like, Margaret, I pledge and I got this stuff, right? I pledge for this because I know how important it is and I know how rare it is to get the true official film, Cuba and African Odyssey. To get the official film, very, very difficult. I had to make special arrangements with the filmmaker, Jihan El-Tahari, to make that available to you. So don't be shortchanged. Don't be sending somebody some money for something that isn't going to be the real thing. The real thing is only available by calling us here at 212-209-2950. So don't get sucked into some scam, okay? We have official permission from Jihan El-Tahari to offer you the original and the true version of Cuba and African Odyssey. I need six of you calling and getting the dollar a day pack where you're going to get four DVDs and two books. Here's the reality of it. 10,000 Cubans died on African soil. The United States used military mercenaries. They hooked up with the apartheid regime in South Africa in the battle for Angola. The battle for Angola was really important because, you know, the Portuguese, they were some of the first colonial powers in Africa. Okay? The Portuguese sailors began exploring the coast of Africa back in 1419. And by the mid-1400s, the Portuguese were sailing further and further south along the coast of Africa. And Portuguese traders built sub-Saharan Africa's first permanent slave trading post in 1492 and began importing slaves back to Portugal at a rate of about 800 a year. Now, we all know now that the estimates say as many as 60 million people were shipped into bondage. All of this started by the Portuguese. So the defeat of the Portuguese on African soil in Angola was pivotal, and Cuba played a major role in it. 212-209-2950. I've got 2 minutes, and 2 minutes, I still need at least 14 of you calling to get Jihan El-Tahari's Cuba and African Odyssey. I'm making the last call for this material. This is it, people. You got to call us now at 212-209-2950. I wanted to play another short clip for you, but I'm really running out of time here, and I want to thank some of you. Let me tell you about this pack. I'm not going to be able to offer this pack anymore because it's four DVDs and two books for a dollar a day. We appreciate it if you could put it on a credit card. The four DVDs are Cuba and African Odyssey DVD, Oliver Stone's, the award-winning director Oliver Stone's Looking for Fidel. You're not going to see anything else like this with Oliver Stone sitting down in conversation with Fidel Castro. the DVD Lumumba, which is a classic. I can't tell you, I love that film. In fact, now that I'm talking about it, I want to go watch it again. It's a classic. The young African leader that was the hope of the liberation movements across the continent of Africa and across the world, and assassinated at a very young age with the help of the CIA. The two books are Madiba A to Z by Danny Schechter, from the makers of the Major Motion Picture Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom. It's a completely unique biography, a thematic telling of the story of Nelson Mandela. The story of how apartheid ended is also in the film that we're having clips from today, Cuba and African Odyssey. The other book is from another playbook of the CIA, but this time in South Africa, with the assassination of left-leaning Salvador Allende in Chile and the installation of a dictator. That's what the U.S. was doing across the continent of Africa, you know, undermining liberation movements and installing corrupt dictators. But I'd like to thank all who helped with today's show. I'd like to thank Jihan El-Tahari for making this film available to us. 212-209-2950. Last call for this material. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Thank you for calling and pledging.
On Friday, October 24th at 6 p.m., join WBAI family and friends for an evening of good music and dancing at our annual salsa fundraiser hosted by Mickey Melendez and Nando Alberici at the world-famous Sounds of Brazil, 204 Varick Street in New York City. Eddie Palmieri and his salsa orchestra tops an impressive list of performers that includes the New Swing Sextet, Gil Filippo Colon and Hot Bread, Cambalache Negro, Ralph Irizarry and Timbalaye, Mauricio Smith and WBAI's own Chico Alvarez. That's Friday, October 24th, WBAI's annual salsa fundraiser at Sounds of Brazil, 204 Varick Street in New York City. Doors open at 6 p.m. and tickets are $20. For more information and tickets, call 212-243-4940. That's 212-243-4940.
This Friday, October 24th, is the fifth and final Friday of the WBAI Feminist Film Festival, and your last chance to experience the event that has packed the house for the last 4 weeks. We'll be showing the transcendent Fundi, the story of Ella Baker. It's the only film on the life of this not well enough known leader of the civil rights movement. And Sweet Honey in the Rock, Raise Your Voice, an award-winning film about the world-renowned a cappella singing group. Plus, we'll have a live performance by veteran singer-songwriter Judy Gorman. So, don't miss out. It's all happening at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Go to WBAI.org for details. Doors open at 6 for shorts, 7:30 for features. The wine is still flowing, and the popcorn is still popping.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale of WBAI's Tuesday evening environmental show, Ecologic. One of the cool things about being a BAI buddy is that you get to decide what WBAI is worth to you. Are we worth more than your cable TV? Or 10 bucks a month? 20, 100, a million? Just go to the WBAI.org website and sign up with your credit card. You'll barely notice it. In return, you get a WBAI tote bag to show off, free or discounted entry to special WBAI events, and other perks. Another cool thing about being a BAI buddy is less fundraising interruptions to your favorite programs. Go to WBAI.org. You can donate in the name of your favorite show, like Ecologic.
Speaking of which, this is WBAI, Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And this is pre-show, basically. We have a couple more promos. Pardon me. I'm going to move this over here so I can actually talk into the mic and look at the computer at the same time. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Kay Tempest Bradford. And we will be holding forth, as it were, till 3 a.m. This is not, well, first of all, even if it were Hour of the Wolf, this would not yet be Hour of the Wolf. This would be sort of the Earthwatch Memorial time slot. But It's fundraising drive. It's time. It's when we need you to ante up, and usually there comes a certain time in the night / morning when it doesn't make sense to be pitching, whether it's the recorded program that you just heard from Sojourner Truth or live people on the air begging for money, because you're past a certain point. But we haven't gotten there yet. It's 12:52, and it's still time in which we can successfully hope to raise a buck or two. But I'm not going to push the pledge line at 212-209-2950. No, not that. Instead, nor am I going to push the normal website address, which is give2wbai.org. Now, I mean, that's why I won't pitch it. How do you say numeral two every bleeping time? It's give to WBAI. Okay, that's clever, but somebody, I guess, already got the TO or something like that. So it was changed. It was changed somehow. I'm just going to tell you, just go to WBAI.org. That's all. There are links there. There are clicks. You go to WBAI.org, and I promise you that there's going to be a link there that's going to try to separate you from your money.
It seems less fun, though.
I'm afraid to tell people, and I won't tell people, what happens if you go to givetowbai.org or .com. But let's just say it's not for young people. And probably preferable for... Well, let's put it this way. Terrence Taylor loved it. Okay, and we'll just, you know...
We'll leave it at that.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that. Those discerning people, those people of taste who know Terrence Taylor will understand. And if not, well...
We'll leave it for them to imagine.
Yeah, I think so. I love Terrence. There are certain things about him best left to the imagination and
mystery.
Yeah, no, not really. not mystery. Not around here. Not when the first people I worked for at this radio station in 1967 in the all-important job of gopher were Baird Searles and Tom Dish and Samuel R. Delaney. Let's just say that yeah, it was a very happy, or should we say gay, community. Curiously, less so today than then. Not necessarily on the air. We have more gay programming now than we had certainly in 1967. But it seems to me, as far as staff are concerned,
that's because they're all making podcasts. All the gay people are making podcasts now.
Okay, let's get into it, shall we?
I mean, I don't know really what all the gay people are up to. Not really.
No, but just about casting, just about media, which is something that Kay Tempest Bradford is very much into. when she's not being a science fiction or speculative fiction writer, when she's not being a journalist, both about technology and culture in general. Is that fair?
True, yeah.
But you're a media watcher.
Mm-hmm.
And often an angry media watcher.
Yeah. I mean,
you're angry at a lot of stuff.
I am.
The name Tempest works.
Yeah.
Yeah. you live up to the name. So, this is something I talked on the air about when Kate Baker was here.
Mm-hmm.
Broadcast is, now, I'm going to use terms that I know Tempest will understand, but a lot of listeners won't. Broadcast is push technology.
Mm-hmm.
And podcast is pull.
Yeah.
Technology. Now, how do we explain to the audience what that means? Push means that it comes to you. You may not even be looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
You turn that dial or whatever, or you turn on that computer, and for better or worse, by your choice or not, it appears.
Right.
So push technology, as far as radio is concerned, is you turn on your radio, you're not necessarily looking for one thing, but there are the different stations, and you just twiddle the dial or do it digitally or however you do it. And there it is. It's coming at you without your having to say, I want this.
Right.
A podcast is pull technology.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, to find a gay podcast, a science fiction podcast, a podcast for any interest group, no matter how broad that group might be, you have to say, I am aware of this podcast, if only by seeing it from a list out of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to subscribe to it. It's not pushed at you,
right,
unless somebody has some advertising out there,
right,
that makes you aware of it.
Yes.
So I don't give people a pass on podcasting. I don't say, yes, that's a good thing, unless what you want is a closed community.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, it's great. But if you want, can you tell I'm actually sort of leading up to why you should give BAI money, folks? It's coming in through, you know, sideways. But I really believe everything I'm saying here. Broadcasting, push technology, the thing that we do that better broadcasters do, is something that is out there for the masses. You can't do consciousness-raising, learning experience so much on a podcast because only the choir is listening in.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare that somebody turns on, listens to a podcast for something they disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
Although they will amazingly turn on the radio for stuff they disagree with. Otherwise, Rush Limbaugh wouldn't exist. Or Howard Stern. Or, you know, these are people whose purpose it is, whose craft in radio. And they're both very smart people. I won't say ethical or anything, but they're both very, very smart people.
Mm-hmm.
Their object is to make your blood boil.
Right.
And if everybody was right, they'd be left.
Mm-hmm.
But they're based on the concept of you tune it in and they capture your attention because they're pushing.
Right.
And this is something that WBAI does. We are a push technology. We are something that anybody can listen to.
Yeah.
And we do this now, you know, not to put down our esteemed colleagues who do a very good job at places that are funded by the government. such as National Public Radio or the public broadcasting system.
The government. And
we are not... Say what?
The government.
The government. The government. well, I mean... Hell, the CBC, the IBC in Australia, and of course the BBC are often very, very good institutions. These are government. In the case of the BBC, it's totally government.
Yeah.
The CBC largely, I believe, if not totally. And the ABC is totally government.
Mm-hmm.
And NPR is partially government, with which I totally disagree. I think that they should be totally government. I think that their budget should be, how do you say, not decuple, double decuple. They need to get 20 times the amount of money that they're currently getting from the government. And PBS, this is also true. Stop pitching people.
Right.
Take my tax money, please. I want to see my tax money, if I earned enough to pay taxes. I'd like to see my tax money going into NPR, PBS, museums like the Smithsonian and places like that before they go to war.
Right.
And stuff like that. So, what this comes down to is... that, in my opinion, they shouldn't be pitching. They should be given the money they need to function and the freedom with which they are constitutionally guaranteed, Goldern.
Yes.
But the alternative to that is listener-sponsored radio, he said, waggling his finger at the microphone. And
where can we get that listener-sponsored radio?
And listener-sponsored radio, truly listener-sponsored radio, as opposed to listener-supported radio, where it's a hybrid of government money. You're going to get brain burn from that slushy there. That was a big chunk. Speaking of brain burn, this is WBAI in New York City. Anyway, you can always do that. You can always say, speaking of this, and do a station break. It always works. It always works. So, with the freedom, we're sort of the opposite. What we are not is financially free.
Right.
Because it costs a lot of money to run the Pacifica Foundation, to run WBAI, especially WBAI, because we have to deal with New York prices.
Right.
On we're moving our antenna from the Empire State Building, which is over $50,000 a month. Well over. And and we're about to get a rent increase. We're going to four times square.
Okay.
We lost our useful, glorious facilities at 120 Wall Street, where everybody was saying, yeah, but we're paying so much money and all that. It was like, actually, not really. I'm a dissenter with the majority of the WBAI staff and management on that. Every time I say, wasn't this subsidized rent? Oh, that's what you were being told. Yeah. Okay. Can you show me this is not true? Because I know what other... I happen to know, I won't name him, a speculative fiction writer who has an office in that same building. I'll tell Tempest his name off the air. She will know who he is. And so he was actually two floors up from us there. And I've gotten certain information about that building, which tells us that, well, there were things that could have been done about the rent. But that's neither here nor there. Should we survive, our facilities will move to 388 Atlantic Avenue.
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, which to me sounded horrible until I went there. Have you ever been at that space yet?
I have only been in that area. It's a nice area.
Yeah, no, the area is lovely, but that building itself is as lovely as the area, and it's a key community space. The owner of that building has all kinds of events for the community there.
Awesome.
I recently held a reading there, which you did not attend because you dissented about one of the two readers.
Also, Brooklyn.
Yeah, well, you see, and you live way north. You live north of where we are now, and we are what they call uptown. Right now, we are uptown. That's with a capital U, people.
Yes.
And you live north of here.
I do. I live in upstate Manhattan.
Yeah.
As it is affectionately called.
Yeah, yeah. I hadn't heard that one before, but I like that.
Yes.
And yeah, Brooklyn is a schlep, is
indeed
the Brooklynese word for it. But having said that, it's near the Barclays Center, mm-hmm, which means you have access. There are actually trains that come closer. There's actually subways that are 1.5 blocks away at the Hoyt Schermerhorn.
Yes,
station.
Even though that's a weird name.
It is. It is, but it was a Dutch.
I don't know who Mr. Hoyt was or Mr. Schermerhorn, but...
Mm. There's a lot of stuff named Schermerhorn all around the northern parts of Brooklyn, which I don't understand why they call that area South Brooklyn.
Nobody knows direction in Brooklyn. They're just like, over there, hipsters, over there, strollers, over there, non-gentrified, deep, dark areas of scariness.
Yeah.
There's
no
direction.
Yeah, I'm in what was a Norwegian area.
Fancy.
Not at all.
Mm.
Not at all. Very, very blue collar.
Oh.
Very blue collar. Very much also a red state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our congressperson, our last two, have been real, I mean, all... If they thought they could get away with it in New York City, they would openly be Tea Party.
Mm. But are they under indictment? That's the real question.
Yes.
New York City, where 95% of our representatives are under indictment.
Our previous Congress thingy was Vito Fasella, who was caught speeding to Congress to cast a vote from his mistress's house, with whom he had children, which his wife in Staten Island was, and children in Staten Island were unaware of. Mm. And he had so much brilliance. Yeah, he came from a family of machine Democrats, which have their own issues.
Mm-hmm.
But he, you know, how can you get worse than that? I'm not sure how much I can get away with saying names on the air without then there being equal time. But it is, in point of fact, that Michael Grimm is under indictment.
Yes, he is.
And I was aware of some of the things that he could have and should have been indicted for, which he hasn't been.
They're different things.
Which were reported by the New York Times.
Yeah.
And his current indictments don't relate on that. And
that's so sad.
So there's a portion of Brooklyn, a sliver of Brooklyn, that is gerrymandered with Staten Island.
Mm.
And I, unfortunately, am in that... just thin little coastal sliver that goes from like Coney Island all the way west.
Mm.
And so, yeah, we're in a...
You have a representative to be proud of.
Oh.
But or something.
But here's the horrifying thing. He had so many problems that even his campaign manager left. It's a close race against this guy, Rekia, about whom I know little other than they had what passed for a debate on the air, which just turned out to be a yelling match. And I'm, you know, it's...
Sad face.
Yeah. You know, we'll be getting rid of one, I believe, in favor of, not a free thinker. I believe. But it may not happen that way. We may hold on to... If we hold on to the indicted guy, if he is his trial is to start somewhere not long after Election Day, and he beats the indictments...
Right. Then he'll be free to threaten to throw more people off of balconies.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be great.
Well, just New York One reporters.
I don't know. I feel like...
I mean, you don't need an indictment. That one alone, right? That one alone. Right? Just go to YouTube, people. And Michael Grimm, that's Grimm as in brothers, two M's. And put in, like, Michael Grimm, New York One.
Right.
And you will see all that you need to see to say, would I vote for this person?
I wouldn't, but I live in a different district, so I don't have to.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't no matter what.
Right.
But I am in that district.
Yeah.
Woe.
Yeah.
Woe upon us.
Woe upon us all.
But getting back.
This is why we need WBAI, I feel like. Because you don't hear a lot about these things on other radio stations because they're too busy talking about some stuff. Some stuff and some things. But on BAI, we're going to talk about being thrown over balconies and how that's not a good way to run a campaign.
That was New York One. Can you imagine if it had been a WBAI person?
Right. What kind of
treatment?
It'll be okay.
We can't
disrespect the New York One reporters.
No! New York One, I was saying off the air, TCM is the one reason I won't cut the cord. Mm-hmm. If I had a second reason, it would be New York One.
I do kind of miss watching New York One. I don't have cable, so I don't get to watch it.
Yeah. They're actually good.
Yeah.
They're actually good. They're like what television news used to be when I was growing up.
Yeah.
They really give you a feeling of, for the most part, bona fide integrity. And actually looking for people that are actually trying to do news.
Yep.
And it was shocking when CNN took them over in ownership that they've been left alone.
Hmm. Yeah, because CNN's a mess right now.
Yeah, but they've left. But they've been in charge of New York One now for like 6 years or something.
Oh.
And it has not affected the quality.
Well, I must admit, I'm also biased towards New York One because I've been on New York One as a talking head.
Yeah, and what show was that?
I think it happened during the news. I don't know because I can't watch because I don't have cable.
Well, everything is the news on New York.
Well, yes, it was, but it's I think it was news. Like, it was, you know, news segments about technology. I was interviewed.
Oh, so you were, okay, so you're in segments.
Yeah. So I was in a segment about the Galaxy Note 4.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year I was in a segment about holiday shopping for tech.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And did you do this at a tech show, like a Pepcom or something? I have to bitch about this, but I should do it.
Well, no, it was at the one that I did last year around this time was actually at a Microsoft event showing off holiday stuff. It was back to school. That's what it was. It was back to school. So it was a back to school event.
Okay.
And the other one was like at the Galaxy Note event here in New York when they introduced the thing.
Yeah, where they expect that. It's the one that's open to all media that I still go to, even though I don't get to write anywhere near as much as you do. But I used to do it full time. I used to be an editor full time in the tech industry for an ongoing major publication and website.
Fancy.
And it was. It is. No, it no longer is because it's always been constantly imploding upon itself as happens in that industry. But I still go to a number of the events, and it's getting harder and harder because there are more TV crews or podcast video cast crews that are you can't get at the booths.
That's right, because they're there. They have to like do their coverage. There's the thing. Here's
where
the
I want to walk up and say, "So, what freebie do you have for me?"
And they say, "No, I can't because I have to be on TV talking about the thing, the glorious thing."
Yeah.
That everyone.
Yeah, it's like I just like a press kit, please, because
no press kit for you.
Really, which reminds me. I have to take my keys out. I have my keys in the computer so that we get our reviews from Daniel Persons, first one of which I'll put on at 1:30.
Woohoo! As a matter of fact, I have that same flash drive.
Yeah, well, we probably got it at the same press event.
That's true. I have so many flash drives. I got rid of a lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
I still have something like 50.
Only?
Because I got rid of a lot of them.
Yes.
I insisted upon them leaving my house.
Yes, no, between my partner and I, we have 3 quarts.
Oh, yeah.
We have quart containers.
Just toss them in
and
there.
And we toss them in there, the ones that we're not actually using.
Mm-hmm.
And we have about a pint of SD cards and 3 quarts. How many gig is that? I don't know, but we got a quart right over there.
Yeah. Someday somebody's going to build the world's largest RAID array with, like, millions of those things because they're just everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, that I've got a on my keychain here. Everybody at home, I hope you... there is a 32 gig...
Oh, that one's nice.
Yeah, and the little one is that's 64.
Oh wow! Is that a Kingston?
Yes.
Ah, Kingston.
Oh, I take it back.
Oh,
it's a mere 16.
Gasp.
I lost my 64.
Gasp.
Yeah, I've been losing things lately. I lost my bag.
No.
I don't know where. But it was after a reading.
Ooh.
And I lost my glasses here, right here, where I am sitting.
Ooh.
And I had to replace them with the ones I'm wearing now, which are green. Do you see that?
Yes.
That
I did notice they have green. A tint.
Yes, they do. And this is because they're digital lenses.
Oh, are those the Gunner ones?
Yes.
Ah. Digital lenses.
Yeah.
I keep thinking about trying to get them, forcing them to give me some free prescription ones.
Well, free would be nice because...
they're expensive.
these glasses, I better not lose these.
Right.
This is 8 bills.
Wow.
They're progressive lenses.
Okay.
You know, and they're shatterproof, and they're glare-free, and they're digital, and all that stuff. And
wow.
I got took.
But...
I do like them.
Yeah, that's always
good. I do have to say that. They are comfortable to wear.
That's good.
But I know, and I'm shocked, that now that I had to pay all that money, and I'm in the room... Where I know I lost the glasses.
Mm-hmm. They just haven't, like, mysteriously reappeared.
Yeah. Exactly.
Maybe they're in the drawer.
You know, I haven't checked there.
Watch them be in there.
Okay. There's a bunch of earbuds in here.
Earbuds.
And the lightning connector for an Apple headphones.
Oh, man. Lightning connectors.
More headphones.
Those things are so expensive.
They are.
I paid $15 for like one cord. It was a sad, sad day in my life, but I had to review a thing on the iPhone, and they gave me the iPhone. They forgot to give me the cord.
Mm.
It was not a good day.
Yeah.
Not a good day.
We have a good hacker show. We have a good computer show. What we don't really have is a really good all-around, end-user tech show,
mm-hmm.
which is something that if we ever get a program, an ongoing program director here again,
that should be a thing that happens.
Yeah, with you, but or if we ever get this super big Hour of the Wolf that I've talked about for what, 2 years now?
4 hours.
3.
But we should have 4. I'm just saying. No. 1 hour could totally be devoted to dancing.
No, yes, there's that. There's that. I forgot about the dance hour within the dance hour of the wolf.
Right.
Exactly, where everybody just gets on all four and howl.
That's right.
Yeah, indeed. But the point is that what you are listening to is very free form, very thought flowing radio. That is a push technology that you know, you don't hear in a podcast. You can't just casually ask for phone calls on a podcast. Is there anybody who's yet figured out how to do interactive calls that people live on a podcast? I don't believe that exists.
Well, I mean, not just sort of random calls. I mean, I've heard some podcasts.
That's preset, right?
Right, yeah, some podcasts with, like, Skype. Whatnots, but you know, it's pre-recorded, so
no, that's the thing. Yeah, no, Skype is, yeah, but I'm talking about right now we have a phone here. I could take listener phone calls from anybody listening right now and put them on the air.
That's right.
You can't do that. The people say, oh yeah, I hear, you know, podcasts take phone calls all the time, and it's like, yeah, isn't it that they say we're going to be recording the show at this hour, and this is the topic, and you can call in during this hour, and then in 2 weeks when we put the podcast up, you can hear your phone call.
Right. Which I guess is sort of fun for somebody.
It can be, but you see, live radio is different.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't take phone calls. I saw a Facebook discussion with Simon Locally, and some listeners saying, well, G-Man, you ought to podcast. And Simon's saying, it's not the same.
It's not.
It really isn't. Even though Locally is one of the most prepared people that I have ever heard when he comes in and he discusses his literary topics and musical and art in general. And he knows his agenda, and he knows what he's going to say in advance, unlike me, where I often go on the air without a thought in my head. And I know there are all those people out there going, Jim, you never have a thought in your head. But aside from that, that's belaboring the obvious. The idea that WBAI, even outside of the other Pacifica stations, and certainly outside of most any other station in the New York area, except maybe those guys in Jersey, FMU, WFMU.
Yeah.
Really, outside of there, freeform radio just does not really exist.
That's sad.
It really is. The kind of thing that, according to Max Schmid, the first real freeform radio was done by Henry Morgan.
Who is that?
Ah, you youngsters. I barely remember him. But he was a pundit, and he was on television on certain panel type shows. He's a humorist and a satirist. But he started with radio. He predates Gene Shepard. Now, is that a name you know?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I thought you might. So he sort of predates Gene Shepard. And Shepard, while very free-flowing, especially in later years, was still not free-form.
Right.
Because he had his rap, he had his stories. He was there to tell a particular story, and he knew a week beforehand what he was going to say. But still, that immediacy of how he did it was amazing. And then Bob Fass came to WBAI with Radio Unnameable, and you can see the movie on Netflix, Radio Unnameable. And sort of reinvented freeform for the left side of the world, for the progressive and looser side of the world.
Cool. I like the progressive side of the world best.
Yeah, yeah. And then came Steve Post. And then Paul Gorman and Julius Lester and Margot Adler.
Yay, Margot.
Yay, Margot. And, oh, by the way, I haven't said this on the air, but I have said it at the last two reading series, that the reading series I run, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, from now on, each October, will be the official Margot Adler Memorial Vampire Readings.
Woohoo!
I need a better name for it than that.
The Memorial Fang Fest.
It's probably been taken.
Probably.
And also, I need Adler, you know, I mean, right. This is her obsession. Her latest and last obsession with her book, Vampires Are Us.
Mm-hmm.
In print from Weiser Books. And
but no sparkly vampires.
No. No, she does. She discusses them.
I know, but we can't have any at the...
But she does not discuss them in a positive sparkly light. But there were some really, really tacky vampire things that she really liked.
I think it's okay.
She liked the softcore porn vampires of, say, Laurel Hamilton.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like tackiness is okay with a vampire, but sparkling is not. I don't know why I draw the line, like where the line is and why, like, sparkling is on one side of it and tacky is on another, but I do draw a line there somehow.
Yeah. But she also, you know, saw it from the point of view of an anthropological, or rather sociological, mm-hmm. point of view that she did in a way for people who love and obsess over vampire stuff, the way that she viewed neo-paganism,
mm-hmm.
with Drawing Down the Moon.
Yeah.
Now, the difference is that's a book that changed the world, at least changed the United States.
Yeah.
I don't think Vampires R Us will do that, but I think that it has an insight at any rate.
Mm-hmm.
I would have vampire readings. I'm not into vampire literature.
Mm-hmm.
Or movies, with the very few exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
I like the Polanski film. I also like one I actually saw with Adler, a film called Byzantium.
Never seen it. I know about it.
Yeah, it's a recent film directed by Neil Jordan.
Yeah.
And I was shocked at how much I liked it. It had content. I have not yet said Only Lovers Left Alive. Is
yes.
that the name of it?
That's the name
one. With Tom Hiddleston and Tilda mm-hmm. Swinton.
Yep.
A cast like that, I would watch anything.
Yes. I am interested in watching that movie, but I'm waiting until I don't have to go in there and be like, because, you know,
it's not that kind of a film.
No, I know, but, like, just, like, there's a reaction to Tom Hiddleston that, like, have to, like, basically just back off from. Because I don't even like Tom Hiddleston that much, but somehow I'm in a room with the image of Tom Hiddleston on a computer and I lose my senses. I don't know what it's about.
Well, I mean, I know people who do that in a very, very positive way.
Yeah, I just...
Is yours not positive?
It's not positive. And mostly it's because I feel as though my reaction to Tom Hiddleston is not born out of any real, like, attraction that I have to him. It's born out of, like, being in a fandom with a bunch of people who are attracted to Tom Hiddleston. And so, like, it's kind of like getting a contact high.
Okay. Yeah. No, I just think he's an incredible actor.
And the things I have seen him in, I've been very impressed with his acting. I haven't seen him in a lot, but the things I have seen, I've been very impressed. Check out
The Hollow Crown.
Okay.
If you're at all into Shakespeare.
Yeah.
They start with, is it Richard II?
Perhaps.
And then they start doing the Henrys, Henry IV, Henry V.
All the Henrys.
Henry IV, 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And then Henry V. In which, of course, he's Hal. He's Prince Hal in
right.
three of those.
Mm-hmm.
And his interpretation, also the fact that this Henry V was directed by a woman mm-hmm. and envisioned by a woman, so that the testosterone that usually oozes from the screen...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really admire the Olivier film. I truly loved the Kenneth Branagh film, despite a couple of issues with it.
Mm-hmm.
But Hiddleston's interpretation, this woman's interpretation, right up until the big battle at Agincourt. Now here's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
When Olivier did the final scenes with Catherine, whoever, usually Catherine and Shakespeare. And usually, you know, just because, you know, somebody, there has to be one woman in the entire story.
Mm-hmm.
There's Olivier sort of like, yeah, he puts up with it. And Branagh and Emma Thompson, of course,
mm-hmm.
had that sparkle on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And they were great. But for some reason, the Hiddleston one just falls apart at that point.
Mm.
When it gets the romance at the end, it just somehow the it's not as scintillating.
Interesting.
And I'm not quite sure why. I'll have to rewatch it. Now they're picking up, it did well enough for the BBC that they're going to be picking up more of The Hollow Crown.
Mm-hmm.
So Henry VI, parts 1, 2, and 3. I've never seen any of that.
That's too many parts.
Yeah, well, that's 6 or 7 hours.
True.
Or more. But then again, I've sat through the Ring cycle and more than once in one sitting. In one sitting.
Yeah, I know.
Because that's
an
annual WBAI event.
Right. I don't even think I have what it takes to do that. The closest I've ever come is watching all of the Lord of the Rings movies, mm-hmm. all the extended editions, all at once.
Yeah. That's very similar. And, of course, it's the same source material.
Yeah. I also did that Marvel thing where I sat through.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah. Yeah,
I could do them on successive nights.
Right. Yeah, I actually wouldn't recommend it. But I did it because I missed doing it with Lord of the Rings. Like when Return of the King came out and they did the thing where they showed the first two movies, extended editions, in the theater, and then they showed Return of the King right after that. And
yeah.
It was like an all-day thing, and I didn't know it was happening until all the tickets were gone. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do this for the Avengers. And now I'm like, no, I'm not doing that ever again.
Yeah. No, that's
when Age of Ultron comes out, I will just be watching Age of Ultron. I will not be sitting through Iron Man 3, Thor 2, Captain America 2, whatever else. I don't even know what else is even happening. Ant-Man, I don't know.
Yeah.
I must sit through all of that.
Well, I'm very curious about Ant-Man, although I was very annoyed that they fired, or didn't fire, but that the director walked off because he was the co-writer and they rewrote it without his input. Is Edgar Wright, who did all the films with Simon Pegg. He's very quirky director.
I don't care about Ant-Man. I don't like Ant-Man.
I don't even know Ant-Man.
I know Ant-Man. I've watched that cartoon. I don't like Ant-Man. Now, Wasp, I'll take. If we could have the Wasp without Ant-Man, that would be so great. But mm-hmm. I don't think they could. Like, they can't conceive of doing Wasp without Ant-Man. But Wasp is so great, and Ant-Man is so boring. I just don't want him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want him. Who else don't I want? There's a lot of dudes I don't want. I mean, I would love to see Black Panther.
Yeah.
But I would really just love to have the Wasp without Ant-Man. But I don't think that we could ever have a world in which we would have the Wasp without Ant-Man. And that's a sad thing.
Maybe so. Maybe so. But, they play around with it.
Yeah, but it's more about the fact that
they're Whedon, you know, it's been Whedonized.
Right, but it's more about the fact
although
that it's
Kevin
like
Feige is
it's
at
a
the
woman,
top of that whole thing.
You know, because like so far all the news that we've heard out of the Ant-Man movie is that they fridged the Wasp anyway, and so I'm like already I'm mad about that. And yeah, I just don't think it's because she's a female superhero. I just don't ever see them like taking the Wasp out of the context of the Ant-Man, even though Ant-Man is so boring.
They have never ever done a good superheroine movie. The Supergirl movie with Helen Slater just didn't
my
cut
gosh,
it.
That movie. I remember watching that movie when I was a little kid and being like, what the heck?
Yeah. heck? I don't believe you said that.
I was a kid, so I said.
And we at WBAI. Oh, okay. Wonder Woman, they have never successfully brought to the screen because I think sometimes for good reasons, like they have not been able to figure out how to do her dramatically without doing bizarre stuff. The TV series I watched recently
mm-hmm.
for the first time, really.
And does it not hold up?
Well, I can't. It It was hilarious. And it knew it was hilarious.
Right.
But, I mean, as Diana Prince's sister, Deborah, help me here, Academy Award-winning actress.
Winger?
Yes.
Okay.
Deborah Winger, as a semi-regular on that show, mm-hmm. as Wonder Woman's sister. As long as the show was set in World War II,
right.
It was hilarious. It was wonderful. And it can be seen on MeTV.
Yeah.
It runs every week.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when they bring it to the modern era, it sort of, you know, just loses it in total.
Well, maybe.
It knew how to do the camp.
Right, but before. It didn't know how to do, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, once again, like, there are things that they do in all the DC movies. I'm like, has nobody asked Bruce Timm or Paul Dini to just come and do the things? Because they did a really good job. Like, if you watch the Justice League cartoon that they did, you know, the way that they brought in Wonder Woman is great because, like, it's not campy. It totally makes sense. It's mm-hmm. totally dramatic. And, you know, she slides right into, you know, the thing with all the other dudes quite easily, you know, and they explored that background a little bit. They did a really good job of exploring the background with the Amazons and whatnot, and she was never ridiculous. One of my favorite things about that series was her crush on Batman. That was the best.
Yeah, I have not watched those, although I have seen a few of them in passing,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, my God, this actually looks good.
Yeah.
The artwork...
I was never a big fan of the art, but that's because the thing that had my heart was Batman, the animated series. And when
that was the one that sort of broke the mold, right?
Yes. And the earlier animation style in Batman, the animated series, I was quite fond of. But when they then added Superman, the Superman animated series, they came up with a different style that was less realistic. One of the things, if you watch these cartoons, you notice that all the men have these ginormous torsos and these teeny tiny hips mm-hmm. and teeny tiny legs. And it's a style, like it's a specific style
that
they're
doing.
Yeah, just
like anime has big eyes.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And so, like, it's not like haphazard or anything, but it just puts me off a lot. And mm-hmm. so it really disappointed
That's
me.
That's why anime puts me off.
Yeah, so it really disappointed me when Batman the Animated Series switched over to that style because they wanted to make it uniform because they knew that they were, like, going to go ahead and do the Justice League later. So there was, like, a major shift in the visuals of that show after Superman came along. And I was just like, oh, no, there's too many. Because, like, and also all the women are very tiny. It's like, you know, this contrast between the superheroes. And I could kind of get if it was just like Superman. But, like, Batman and Superman had the same body.
that's a little off.
It's a little off-putting. The Flash is a little bit slimmer. Like, his shoulders are not as giant as Batman and Superman's shoulders. Mm-hmm. And so his body looks like a little bit more proportioned.
Now, I've heard good things. I have not yet watched. I've heard good things.
Oh, about the new Flash?
About the new Flash.
I'm excited. I haven't watched it yet.
I liked the one from the 80s.
I didn't see it.
It was decent. It was good for its era.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the guy playing the Flash came out.
Mm-hmm. And they're like, you're doing a different type of Flash and we don't like you.
They just canceled the series immediately.
Yeah. It's just terrible.
It was a horrible thing. Apparently, he has a role in the current series.
Oh, good.
You know, it's like they were fully aware of how he had gotten hecked over.
Right. Hecked.
Well, you said, what the heck? I can't imagine you ever using... That
Other
mild
words.
Language.
Other words.
So I'll say that he got hecked over. it's sort of like the people who create a lot of things like X-Men, where they were work for hire.
Mm-hmm.
And the comic book writers get paid, not poorly, they get paid zero.
Mm.
For the movies that are made off of their writing.
Yeah.
And, but the better directors of those films hire some of those writers to to have actual roles, not just, you know, a Stanley, right. Hi, I'm here.
Oh, the Stanley, hi, I'm here.
Yeah, no comment, other than I think they're hecked up. And but Chris Claremont had a very nice, meaty little over five lines role. Mm-hmm. In Days of Future Past.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
He's one of the senators.
Oh.
And Chris sat where you are now sitting and saying, and best of all, I got my SAG card back.
Awesome.
Now SAG-AFTRA, of course. WBAI is a SAG-AFTRA shop.
Uh-huh.
For those who get paid, all two or three people.
I guess at least two and a half people.
Yeah, there's seven, I believe. There's seven people.
Well, I cannot but approve. I have not seen Days of Future Past yet. As I was explaining to somebody recently, X-Men 3 broke me. X-Men Origins Wolverine shattered me. And so I know I need to see it. I know I need to see First Class.
Here's the thing. The ones that you named, the two that you named, were not directed by Bryan Singer.
Yeah, but it's
and this one even, and Days of Future Past is.
It's not even Bryan Singer. Like, I don't think that Bryan Singer could have helped, because X-Men 3 was just terrible from stem to stern.
See, I think he could have. I think that he deserted the series for the shinier lollipop, which was
Superman.
A Superman reboot.
That was
one
so
of many.
Terrible. That movie was so terrible.
That was
at least,
sad.
It was sad, but at least he took James Marsden with him, and that is, I can only thank him for that, because the only good thing about X-Men 3 is that Cyclops dies, and I play that part over and over. The only sadness is it didn't happen on screen. Like, I really just need to see Jean Grey, like, stab him and then pick him apart atom by atom.
Yeah.
I really don't like Cyclops.
I got that impression. I really do.
Mm.
But the now X-Men First Class was not great, mm-hmm. but I enjoyed the concept. I enjoyed the idea of the reboot, and you had some really good actors doing the young parts. But in Days of Future Past, you get the really good old guys and the really good young guys.
Mm-hmm.
And and a really bizarre, interesting, well-done story. And actors like Peter Dinklage.
Yeah.
And all that.
I still feel bad that it wasn't Kitty Pryde that gets to go.
Well, yeah.
But at the same time, I know that the movies have not really done well by Kitty Pryde. So I can't. I mean, they did much better by Wolverine.
Well, yeah. He sells more tickets, but, I mean, Kitty Pryde, after all, is being played by... Oh, God, why am I blanking?
Ellen Page.
Ellen Page, who is box office.
She is, but...
If you put her front and center,
she would sell... really boring in that role. That was the problem. Like, and it wasn't
Well, it's
really
the
her
writing.
Fault. Yeah, it was writing.
It's like, the writing.
It wasn't her fault.
So the point is, you write well for her.
Yeah.
She will bring in the audience.
Yeah.
But it was simply pointed out by the author of the comic book, mm-hmm. of Days of Future Past, who put Kitty Pryde in that role in the comic book, that it doesn't work in the movie because in the comic book, she goes back to, like, the late 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie, because they're trying to, follow up on the Cuban Missile Crisis. No, the first movie is the Cuban Missile. It's some other crisis. It's in the early 70s.
Right.
And Kitty Pryde wasn't born. She could not go back into her own body, whereas Wolverine is considered semi-immortal.
Right.
So there actually is a logical reason. There are some rules that in movies you have to pay attention to, things that are totally discardable in long-lived comic books.
Yeah. Okay.
And that particular excuse I bought.
Mm-hmm. Well, also because just Wolverine. People come for Wolverine.
They do.
And then they leave writing the Wolverine Charles Xavier slash.
But they're going to be But they're going to be writing Wolverine off because
they have to. He's dead, but I just
Well, no, forget that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the Spider-Man and Superman are also dead.
Right.
That doesn't mean anything. No, you see, there's one basic problem.
Hugh Jackman keeps aging.
That's it.
It's like, oh, he's immortal, but what about all that gray hair? What about all those wrinkles?
They're going to have to do something to bring... you can always bring in another actor.
Yeah,
that's very
try.
Doable. They've had three Hulks in one decade.
I can see... but here's the difference between Wolverine and Hulk. They've had three Hulks, and nobody cared about those dudes that much. People care about Hugh Jackman, because he's so pretty.
Yeah.
I mean,
and he's a really fine performer.
But also, he's pretty pretty.
Yeah.
Although I do feel like now, maybe you couldn't take Hulk away from Mark Ruffalo, because he's everybody's teddy bear.
How did he manage that? I mean...
Because he's everybody's teddy bear.
He was great.
Not only that, but like... Pretty much all of fandom just wants to cuddle him. They just want to, like, put him in a corner and just, like, cuddle him and talk to them about their day. Like, that's what they want.
Yeah.
So I don't think that we can... Nobody wanted to cuddle with Ed Norton. And I don't think anybody wanted to cuddle with Eric Bana at all.
Yeah. although I have to say, that was not a successful movie. That was not a good movie. But I liked the style that Ang Lee... brought his interpretation of how a comic book can be done on screen, where you actually saw the panels coming in on the screen using like 1960s, 70s split screen effects and doing it as like Steve Ditko style or Neil Adams style panels.
Yeah.
And bringing them in and taking them apart the way the directorial sense that he brought to that movie was very good, even though it wasn't a good movie.
Yeah, this is true. The second one was a better movie. It still wasn't that great, but it was a better movie, like just as an object.
It bored the hell out of me.
Yeah.
And he destroyed where we are sitting.
That's true.
He destroyed Harlem. And
yeah,
they used that to advantage in the Avengers.
I was like, man.
It's like, we're going to New York, you know, like.
If only he had destroyed that horrible Red Lobster next to the Apollo Theater, I would have forgiven it.
Yeah, right? But.
I hate the Red Lobster. yeah, it wasn't great, but it was an okay movie.
Yeah, I just didn't care for it.
I watched it for the first time during that marathon leading up to the Avengers, actually. I'd never actually gone to the theater and seen it because I was like, why would I do that? And I was right. It was not something I wanted to see.
Yeah.
But I watched it.
For me, it just didn't have the quality that the others did. And I was shocked at how much I liked Guardians of the Galaxy.
I like Guardians of the Galaxy a lot.
I was not going to. I thought, why are they making this? I didn't know the book.
Mm-hmm.
I had not seen the book. The only thing that I was reading at the time, that era, was the comic book, Howard the Duck, which I really loved because it was just too off the wall. The Steve Gerber stuff was, including when it went from color to black and white.
Right. Well, you know.
Especially when it went from color to black and white. And had ended up with Howard in battling Anita Bryant. And, you know, this was totally off the wall. And Guardians of the Galaxy had that kind of DNA in it. That really off-the-wall DNA. But my favorite Marvel superhero, because I was never a big comics person, they're going to do a movie of, apparently, and that's Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Master, where at WBAI we did a radio drama series with better special effects than they will ever pull off in any movie. Mind's eye. And the question is, who will... They're throwing out around all kinds of names. But
Look, if they don't hire Alexander Siddig or Odet Fehr, I don't want to hear anybody else's name.
Siddig could do it. Who's the other...
Odet Fehr?
I'm not sure who that is.
He's a guy, you probably have seen him in so many things, but don't know his name because I don't think he's ever headlined anything in America. Did you ever see The Mummy?
Yes.
Oh, but like
I saw The Mummy Returns more than The Mummy.
I don't think he was in The Mummy Returns. But anyway, he's
too many insects.
I believe he's Egyptian, and so he's often playing somebody quote Arab in a movie.
Well, Doctor Strange is from New York, but that doesn't mean he can't be multicultural.
Right, but I just feel like Odette Fair.
And by the way, Marvel movie people, Doctor Strange is a good place to start with more multicultural.
Yes,
characters.
I mean, I just want Odette Fair to play him because I want Odette Fair to play everyone, so I can look at him.
Mm-hmm. But you still haven't become a fan of Adrian Lester.
No.
Shame.
No, I'm still. It's because
it's because you haven't seen him.
I think it's just Odette Fair is just like too much in my brain. And then when I stopped thinking about Odette Fair, I started thinking about
Because you and I were talking about Adrian Lester when you were pushing for, what is his name, Idris Elba?
Oh, Idris Elba to be the doctor.
To be the doctor.
Yeah.
And he was actually offered the role, it turns down, to be the 11th doctor, and he turned that down, which is why he was not asked to be the 12th. He had already been asked and turned it down, where I was pushing for Adrian Lester. And that's when we had that conversation, and I told you, oh, you must see the earlier seasons of Hustle or some of the Shakespeare that he's done.
Yeah.
The first time I saw him, I didn't know he was British. He's the lead in, what's the movie that's basically John Travolta as Clinton?
And Wag the Dog, is that?
No.
John Travolta. I know what you're
John
talking
Travolta
about.
Plays Clinton, and Emma Thompson is Hillary.
I forget what movie that is, but yeah, that's what I thought Bates. It was. It was something like, was it Primary Colors?
Yes, that's
it. Okay,
it's called Primary Colors.
Yeah.
Adrian Lester is the lead in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's his perspective that we are following. He's the person who joins the campaign and becomes... with Billy Bob Thornton and a woman whose name I don't recall, and Kathy Bates. They are the campaign runners.
Yeah.
And I did not know he was English. He did it so well.
Yeah. He's pretty awesome, I guess.
Adrian Lester, he is. He is, and he would have been a great doctor. He still could be a great doctor. Although, you haven't seen it yet. Peter Capaldi is
doing it for me.
He is excellent.
I have nothing against Peter Capaldi. I even thought that maybe I was going to start watching Doctor Who again because I was like, I'll check out this Capaldi fellow. He seems nice. And then I saw the list of writers and directors for the episodes for this season. There were no women.
Has not been since the reboot of the series. Now, the producers are largely women.
Well, no, there have been women writers in the Davies era. Because, what's her name? Helen Rayner. Wrote one or two episodes.
I thought it was zero.
No, there was Helen Rayner, and I feel like there was at least one other woman on Doctor Who. And then on Torchwood, Helen Rayner and Catherine Tranica.
No, Torchwood, yes.
But Helen Rayner wrote the Daleks in Manhattan episode. I'm one of the few
who liked that episode.
I was meh about that episode.
No, I'm the only one who sort of enjoyed that, just because of the era and the...
Yeah. But
the Busby Berkeley rip there.
But there are no women writers, no women directors. And I was like, I can't support this. And now they decided on bringing on some more women directors, I think, for this season. So maybe there's one?
No, not so far.
Oh, okay. I remember like vaguely hearing that.
Well, you know, I haven't looked at the names of the directors. The producers.
Right.
With the exception of Peter Moffat, the producers are all women.
Yeah. So it's very disappointing. And so I was just like, I can't do this. I cannot watch another season of Stephen Moffat at the head of men doing man things. No,
well, you see, I can't say too much about what's been going on lately without giving out too much spoilers, but the very character who the last season I won't say loathed, but found totally useless, was Jenna Louise Coleman, now just Jenna Coleman. And she has, in this season, turned out to be fabulous.
And she's a good actress. There was nothing ever wrong with her acting. It was they gave her to do terrible.
I'm talking about the character.
Oh, yeah.
Of Clara Oswald is who I dislike, not Jenna Coleman.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean,
But, they've turned her around in a big way. Suffice it to say, at the end of one episode, she just totally tells the doctor off righteously.
Mm.
And in two episodes after that, she becomes the doctor. Okay, so the thing is, we're talking about a dark doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Not evil kind dark, but one who questions... and there's a whole question about what that last, which is just last week's episode, was about. I think the point was that the doctor gets to see Clara become the doctor, and he sees, rule number one, the doctor lies.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of lying going on, a lot of this and that going on. And at the end, she says, come on, admit it. I was a good doctor, wasn't I? And he said, you were an excellent doctor. Goodness had nothing to do with it.
Mm.
And it's like, whoa. And that was the last line.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, okay. So the doctor, the whole season began with the doctor saying, am I a good man?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the arc. It's instead of a story arc, there's some kind of story arc, which is like, I can do without. But there's a character arc.
Right.
That's largely about Clara. That for once is working.
Hmm.
Because in the previous last two or three Matt Smiths, I loved his first year.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone after that are totally dispensable.
Yeah, pretty much.
As far as I'm concerned.
That's pretty much. I mean, I didn't even like his first year that much, but at least it was watchable. But I gave up. I gave up before the anniversary special. Like, I still haven't seen it. I still haven't seen Name of the Doctor. I still haven't seen any of that. So I was just like, I don't care.
You know, there are many fun moments in there, but here's the problem. Use the word special, and they weren't.
Yeah, but then again, most of the specials aren't.
Yeah, but come on, the 50th anniversary.
I know. Well, you know... 50th anniversary, as put together by Stephen Moffat, who we all know is the most terrible.
You see, here we differ. I think that, okay, here's what I think. I think that he's a bad showrunner, but a brilliant, brilliant writer for the show.
I disagree.
Well, I know you disagree. I knew that a long time ago.
Right.
You and I have been on panels about this at conventions. Yeah.
But I think that he is a good writer, but the things that he relies on as a writer,
mm-hmm.
They get old, and it depends how much you are engaged with it and paying attention.
I'm sorry to tell you this, but I agree. he has a tendency to dig a new well, and it's a great well, but when he dip into that well a second time, it's like been there.
Right.
We don't need the weeping angels a second time. We didn't need it the fourth time.
Nope. We did not. And like every time they came back, they got worse. Every time they came back, it's like, this is now even more stupid and ridiculous and unbelievable than it was
before.
And
some of the stuff that he has created that was brilliant that we're not seeing anymore. Captain Jack, River Song.
But see, he didn't create Captain Jack. Like that's the thing. Even though he wrote that episode, that was Russell invented Captain Jack, but he gave... You know, Captain Jack.
Now, that I have not heard.
Yeah, Captain Jack was always in Russell's plan, but he gave Stephen Moffat those episodes.
It's a very Russell-like character, give you that.
Yeah, so Stephen didn't come up with Captain Jack. That was just like, Russell's like, this is what I want done, and, you know, I want you to do it because I know you can because you're awesome and because you love Doctor Who and et cetera.
Yeah.
But everything else that came after that was
Well, I think that about the worst episodes are usually written by Mark Gatiss.
Oh,
and the best episodes are, Winston Churchill and the Daleks? Come on.
Mm.
Although you had an episode this season that wasn't bad.
Okay. I haven't seen it. I didn't like the Dalek Winston Churchill one, but that's just me.
No, that was horrible. That was horrible.
Oh my God.
I like the poster from it. I have
the poster.
The poster,
yeah.
Is great.
I mean, like, the idea of it is okay, but then the
Daleks
actual
for victory in World War II. Yeah, no, it was an awful episode. Mm. But... Here's what I think. I think Mark Gatiss should be the showrunner. And Stephen Moffat should be one of his head writers.
No. Because here's the thing.
And the other way around on Sherlock.
Even if you just demote Stephen back down to a writer, like, even before he got a hold of things, he was doing things that were bad. For instance, Girl in the Fireplace, which so many people
it's
love.
It's not my favorite.
Everybody's like, it's okay. Girl in the Fireplace. She said, blip, blip, whatever. Girl in the Fireplace did not make any sense in the context of anything else that was going on.
I just rewatched that one recently, so yeah. I'm actually competent to talk about it again.
You know,
I didn't love it.
Right, because it's like all the things.
Well, what I like about it, there's one thing I like about it.
Right.
It's sense of time differentiation. The characters don't work.
Right, the characters don't work, because like, the doctor just does things that you're just like, but he wouldn't do that. Like, literally last episode, he was doing things that would make it impossible for him to be acting this way in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, well, Stephen Moffat was always creating his own pocket universes.
That's true in Whodum. Whenever they get a writer who they want, mm-hmm. not that I would mention Neil Gaiman, but whenever they would get a... they give that writer license.
Right, but even Neil
too
Gaiman...
Too much license.
Even in that Neil Gaiman episode, and granted...
He's on two.
Is there, okay, I haven't seen the second one, but in the first one, The Doctor's Wife.
Yeah.
The Doctor was at least acting in character that whole time.
Yes, but it was out of canon.
It was out of canon, maybe, but, like, canon, I'm not as worried about as character. It's specifically, like, when you're talking about the character arc of a season. Like, this...
Okay.
What was, like, it was the second season, yeah, when Girl in the Fireplace happened. And the arc of that season...
I call it the 27th season, but okay.
The arc of that season between the Doctor and Rose was them specifically just acknowledging, you know what, this is, we're in some kind of weird romance relationship. Like, there was sort of a bit of denial in it in the first, you know, reboot season with Christopher Eccleston, because the Doctor was like getting over stuff and whatever, and he didn't want to really deal with, you know, expressing out loud in a human way, the way he felt about Rose.
Well, but, he's not human.
But, right, because he's not human. But the 10th Doctor was much more comfortable with that, and it was really clear that that's where they were going. And then Girl in the Fireplace happens, and he's just like, look, another shiny blonde. I'm going to go chase after this shiny blonde. And you're like, what are you doing? You left the blonde that you have already on the ship that she can't fly
mm-hmm.
with your romantic sexual
life. And that's a Martha episode, isn't it?
No, that's a Rose episode.
Girl in the Fireplace?
Girl in the Fireplace was Rose's episode. That's why it made no sense for him to go chasing after Renette in the way that he did. Like basically, he was like, ooh, shiny blonde. I'm running after that shiny blonde. And it's like, no.
Well, yeah, well, there's a different thing for Moffat that I see, and I'm just positing this as an idea that's coming to me now. I think that he has a thing for kids who grow up in the blink of an eye, a.k.a. Mm-hmm. Amelia turns into Amy.
Right.
No, 5 minutes.
Not even kids. Girls. Grew up worshipping some older dude
mm-hmm.
Who they then idolize and want sexually,
yeah.
even though he's way older, and they met him when they were 10.
Well, that Madame makes me Pompadour worry. Doesn't want him sexually.
Yes, she does. It's made very clear. Yes, she does.
I miss that.
Okay, yeah.
I miss that.
Yes. And it makes me actually wonder about what goes on.
I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying I saw it recently and, you know, it went over my head.
Yeah.
Or as Ellen Kushner will say in this week's Women Destroy Fantasy, guys carrying girl cooties.
Yeah.
But,
But the other thing that he always would do...
Her intros, by the way, for Women Destroy Fantasy are great. But anyway, that's sorry, awesome. Go on.
The thing that he would do when he wasn't the showrunner is he was consistently sidelining whoever the companion was in favor of his own crappy companion. Like Renette. Like Sally Sparrow. Okay, Sally Sparrow isn't his crappy companion. As a matter of fact, I actually wouldn't mind seeing Sally Sparrow become
There are a lot of characters that could be great companions that never are, and I'm really, really disappointed that River Song... it was weird having her married to Matt Smith because Alex Kingston versus Matt Smith.
Right.
But it would not be weird to have River Song and Peter Capaldi.
Right.
Alex Kingston and Peter Capaldi, age appropriate and cheese semi-time lord.
Right. And well, it wasn't even the age thing that bothered me, because I could have...
Well, it's what bothers them. It's a show for 8-year-olds. We have to remember that at the top levels of the BBC, and this is what my theory of what happened